Ahead and pick up in chapter 3 of Malachi. Chapter 3, probably the most famous chapter, not probably, the most famous chapter of this book. Start up chapter 3, that's on page 1040 in the Pew Bible. And so we're picking up here. We left off with the last discourse, the last disputation, the last sort of lawsuit against the people of Judah, and now we move into the resolution of that. How do we fix this problem of the priests and the people being united in their covenant unfaithfulness? How do we solve that problem? And that's kind of a big deal. This isn't just a matter of some weird things happening in this post-exilic community, and it's kind of interesting historically. Because remember, the entire salvation of the world flows through this community. So if they're screwing it up, and salvation seems to be in jeopardy, then it isn't just the salvation of this group of folks that's on the line here. It's, as we talked about earlier in the book, it's the salvation of the entire world that is on the line here. So it is incredibly important. What comes next? How do we solve this problem? And as Christians, we should have some ideas about how this is solved. This should not be a shocking pronouncement that comes in, but it is fascinating what we see here in terms of it telling us things about our lives within the new covenant and our lives in the, you know, ourselves being now post-exile people, right? Because the exile for us in Christ is over, right? Peter says, we're people who used to not have a nation. People used to not have mercy. Now you have it all in Christ, right? But let's take a look at chapter 3, and we're going to take our time a little bit here. Our goal is to get through about 4 verses, just because there's a lot going on, particularly in verse 1. All right. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant, whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. Okay, so there, something we got to track down here as we think through this is there's at least 4 people in this verse that we kind of got to figure out who they are. At least 3, maybe 4, right? We got to kind of work that out. At least 4 kind of characters in the verse that we got to decide who these all are, right? And again, we have some advantage in that Jesus later tells us who they are. But that's where we're going to kind of come at this a little cold and kind of figure out what's going on here. So you have the person speaking, like there's a person. You have the messenger preparing the way. Okay, that's somebody. You've got the Lord. Kind of want to nail down who that is. And then there's this messenger of the covenant. You want to know who all these folks are kind of exactly in this. So the first, you know, person, obviously the speaker, tells us in the verse, Seth, the Lord of hosts. Boom, got that. That's really helpful. So the one speaking here is the Lord of hosts, the Lord of Sabaoth, who's, again, consistently revealed in this way throughout the book. I mean, he's not some abstract deity. He's not some distant, non-powerful abstract force. He's the Lord of the heavenly army. He's coming to set things right. Like, that's whenever we think of the Lord of hosts, that's what we kind of want to be thinking. He's not the host of just some random force. He's the Lord of the army that's coming to set everything right. That's that title. There's a reason we sing that in the Te Deum all the time, because that's a victory song, right? And it's a song, again, that was often sang at victories. But yeah, Lord of Sabaoth, he's coming. We're going to work through who everybody else is in the verses. We kind of work our way through it. But we got that. Lord of hosts, that's the easy one. That's the, got to know who that is. That's God, the living God. Okay? All right. So, how do we start this verse off? Behold, I will send my messenger. So this kind of use of behold in the Old Testament, and again, we'll talk about that in the New Testament, but specifically in the Old Testament, this is in a context of something's immediately going to happen. And it's also meant to fill us with kind of a foreboding or foreshadowing of what's happening. Like, you hear some of this kind of coming out with behold, then says something like, here it's, behold, I will send my messenger. We're not supposed to think like, oh boy, the messenger's coming. Yay. You know, they're like, no, it's like, what? Who's coming? What's happening? There's a sense in this of a fear of this thing that's happening, right? Which is a thing we want to start off with how this verse hits us. We don't want to jump all the way to how we know how the story ends. We want to hit this as this hits us from the Old Testament context is foreboding. Now, what's interesting is you'll see Mark do this a ton in his book. Lots of beholds in his take on it. His way he frames things, which in and of itself is meant to sort of have us, you know, if you're thinking about this in kind of a Hebrew mindset, the behold is kind of means something is imminently happening, right? It's kind of the sense of this. So that's also built into kind of Mark's gospel, which sort of always feels like it's in a hurry to get where it's going. You know, Matthew, let's have a real long genealogy to get us started. Mark's like, and then stuff went down. And again, probably, there are lots of theories about why that is. There's the kind of prevailing academic theories that Mark's gospel is first. But if you really throw that, kind of figure that out, like unwind all that, like why do people think that? The evidence is pretty scant. It just usually comes down to, because shorter things usually come before longer things, is what it kind of comes down to. Which the exact argument, opposite argument could be made. You have something longer that you then make shorter. It makes just as much sense. And so I'm a big Matthew first guy, and then Mark kind of makes the Reader's Digest version of Matthew's gospel. And that's what you kind of get. But again, not going to go to a war on that. That's just what I think probably happened. But here we have this sense of action is coming, right? Because remember, the community is lamenting that God's not acting. And so this starts off by saying imminent action is on the way, right? The something is coming your way in this sense. So the question then remains, who is being sent, right? Who is this messenger? Who's coming? And so the Hebrew word here used for messenger, sometimes it can be used for a heavenly messenger, but most of the time, particularly in the post-exilic literature, it's always human or prophet, right? A human or prophet. This messenger who's coming to prepare the way. Which brings us to this understanding of, so we think about this messenger, the preparing messenger, because there's two messengers in this verse. You gotta figure out who they are. But the preparing messenger, we can say with a pretty firm contextual evidence that this is a man, right? That this is a man in this case. A human prophet is coming. So what does this prepare stuff mean? What do we mean by prepare? Prepare the way before me. Another way you could translate this is to like clear stuff away, to move things out of a path. When you think of sort of preparing a road, what do? You gotta like get all the debris out and then you gotta make a road, right? And this speaks to the Near Eastern practice of when a king was visiting someplace, you would clear out all the brush and make a nice path for him to enter your city, right? You wanted to put your best face forward. We still do this kind of thing, right? This is still very much a thing that happens. There was a kind of a jokey way. There's when the president or the premier Xi Jinping was going to visit San Francisco, to like got all the bums out and like put up all this Chinese stuff and said, "Look, here he comes!" Hey, like it was just kind of a fascinating thing to think about who rules what. But in any event, that sort of thing still happens, right? Whenever someone important shows up, you got to get the way ready.
It's called a dog
pony show. Yes, but it is. For like, but in this context, like the actual king who's coming has a gigantic amount of power, and you don't want him to think of your place as being disrespectful to him, right? So there is some real danger here in not having the way prepared for the king who's coming. There's like lives hanging in the balance in terms of him thinking your community is slighting him. And the image is here is of the messenger preparing the way, getting the roads open and clear. For the king to come in. In this case, who is the king? Who's coming? It's God, right? Got to be very clear about what is being said here. How does the covenant unfaithfulness get solved? It doesn't get solved by everybody just trying a little bit harder. It doesn't get solved by, man, if you feel it in your heart, maybe we can undo everything. Or let's have a good cry even doesn't solve it. Let's sing Kumbaya, maybe it'll all get fixed. No, what solves it is God showing up to set things right. That is what's being prepared here. And so the imagery of this, of course, is the figurative meaning of this is that the messenger comes, because again, a messenger, when you think of a messenger, you don't think of a messenger like cleaning up the streets. That's not what you think of as a messenger. What's the medium by which a messenger does things? They speak, right? They bring a message. And so this is a figurative way of saying that there's a messenger coming who's going to prepare the people for God to come, right? And that is what's being talked about here. Why is that important? Well, it's important because you have two ways in which this sort of is seen in this prophecy is set forward in the Old Testament. You have the Isaiah's prophecy of this, of course, there's a messenger coming and he's bringing deliverance. And you have the Malachi prophecy, he's coming and bringing judgment. And both those things have to work in tandem, or you misunderstand the God coming event, right? There's deliverance and judgment coming in the God event. And you hear Jesus say this all the time. And you must also hear it from whom? John, who you're named after. Very good. Nailed it. John the Baptist, right? As the dumb Facebook meme I saw the other day, it's John the Baptist, not John the Catholic. Get it right. it's like, oh Fred, let's have a quick talk about this. That is not, well, technically accurate. Not at all what was meant here. Another way of saying it is John the Baptizer, the baptizing one, is what that means. It doesn't mean he's affiliated, like, you know, the secret affiliation, the trail of blood, the blood trail that there's just secret Baptists from John the Baptist all the way through, got repressed by Constantine and then worked their way and they were just in secret. Nobody wrote anything or talked about it. It was all hidden. And then they pop out again in the 17th century and then the church is saved. That's a ridiculous thing to believe. I'm sorry. And I cannot take a person seriously as that kind of view of history any more than I run, of course, that we can take like sort of, you know, Newman's Roman Catholic view of history, like, yeah, you can't really find any of this stuff, but it's like, it's there, and it like shows up, and it's okay. Like, all those kinds of views of history are quite silly, and we actually don't believe them. But here, wonderfully, of course, we're talking about this messenger who prepares the way is John the Baptist. And you hear it in the way he's talking, you hear it in the very way he talks about himself. He is the embodiment of this Malachi prophecy coming true. Jesus is bold enough to tell us that, you know, he is the Elijah that comes before him, right? When his apostles are talking to him. He's the messenger who comes, the prophet who comes before, to prepare the people. And he prepares the people by some real tough talk and by also baptizing them, right? And a baptism, what? For a remission of sins. It's a specific baptism for remission of sins, not just for proselytes, but for everybody. Everybody needs this baptism because you're all sinners and God is coming. You need to purify yourselves. Get ready. Because God's coming. Now, why is that important? Well, by invoking this prophecy, both in John the Baptist and in the gospel writers, when they're writing all this and telling us all these things are happening, you have to recognize that they are invoking the very idea that Jesus Christ is God, right? So this sort of hot nonsense you will see people like Bart Ehrman say, or other silly people who want to make a buck. Well, no one, like, the Gospels, they don't really, you know, they don't talk about Jesus being God, or they didn't really think of him being God. This comes later on in the tradition. This is just as dumb as that blood trail nonsense. Because if you understand the prophecy that's being invoked by the men involved and written down by the gospel writers and also by Paul, you recognize that there's no way to look at this except they see Jesus as God, right? That God has come. And this is interconnected into the Messiah, don't get me wrong. But they recognize prophetically that this is God who's come. And that's why that's incredibly, gigantically important. And would have been super obvious to anyone who knew these prophecies. The only reason false teachers get away with confusing modern-day Christians is because they're unfamiliar with these prophecies and get bamboozled that way. And that's the reason that works. But if you know this, you're like, geez, whatever anybody's saying in this, they are definitely saying that Jesus is God. Because that's the one who's coming. That's the one who's coming to his temple. Right? And that's what all that stuff, like, why do they care so much about Jesus going to the temple all the time? But gosh, I mean, John starts off his gospel with that. Right? It's one of the first things that happens is Jesus goes to the temple, right? And gets the money changers out. But again, and he talks about himself as being in the temple and, you know, and all those things. And then continually you have this sort of motif of Jesus being in the temple, going to the temple, coming out of the temple, going near the temple. Like, what is that all about? Again, it's a fulfillment of this prophecy that God is coming to his temple, right? And when God returns to his temple, this prophecy is fulfilled when Jesus Christ walks in the door, right? And it is not fulfilled before that, right? That's the fulfillment of this prophecy, which makes perfect sense because the one who paves the way is there too. So you got John the Baptist, you've got Jesus, boom, it's all there. Within this prophecy. But that means we do have to hold on as we continue to read through this, kind of thinking through what does that look like and the seriousness of it. We don't want to just sort of lean on the Isaiah side of it, which is like, man, don't get me wrong, the Isaiah prophecies are amazing and fantastic. The Malachi prophecy is a little harder and rougher. And we have to hold those two things together in tension, or we lose out on what's happening in the God event, in the incarnation, right? That this is prophesying.
He's trying to basically prepare them for a nuclear reactor is about to descend on you guys.
The equivalent of, right? Yes.
Yes. Maybe you don't question.
Sure.
I suppose the first time Jesus entered the temple, was he as a child?
Yes. Yes, yeah. So you have the presentation, right, when he's brought into the temple. Yeah, and there's a lot there that's within that story. And matter of fact, there's a reason that's a holy day, right, in our church calendar. When they were paring back holy days, one of them they didn't get rid of was the presentation. Why? Because it's a big deal when Jesus shows up. Yeah, that God shows up at the temple. That's a big deal. So, but that, again, that's one of the sad things about, like, throwing out the whole calendars, you miss those kind of yearly remembrances of these things that happen within the life of Christ that are gigantic moments in our salvation history. And that's, like, that, for example, is a really important one that we continue to remember every single year. Okay. So we continue on. The final three lines of verse 1 are this sort of sense of, and the Lord whom we seek shall suddenly come to his temple. We talked about that. Even the messenger of the covenant. You know, the suddenly is important there. The idea of suddenly coming to his temple. That's also meant to be an intimidating thing. There's this kind of force to it, right? The judge is coming, foreboding. It is meant to put us on edge, particularly the priests and the people, as we'll see. But there's a harsh edge to this that we can't miss out in this prophecy. The suddenly kind of speaks to that. Suddenly comes to even the messenger of the covenant, whom we delight in. So this messenger of the covenant is kind of a hard bit because it's not used anywhere else in the Old Testament. I think the King James Version does a really good job of connecting these titles. So you have, and the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. So here, this makes a lot more sense, like we talked about sort of messenger as being oftentimes speaking about a human. It also can speak of someone divine, And so this, the covenant part of this is why this kind of explains it to us. This messenger of the covenant, he's the one who, in many ways, we're answering the questions or the complaints of the people, particularly in 2:17, where they said, where is the God of judgment? Everyone that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delighteth in them. Right? There's this idea at the end of 17, verse 17 of chapter 2, that the people's complaint is basically that God has forgotten his covenant. God doesn't even, or worse, God has subverted his covenant in such a way that he's destroying us. And the messenger of the covenant is a title given to the God who's coming, because he's the one who brought them the covenant. He's the one who judges the covenant. And so far from the idea that God has forgotten his covenant or is subverting it, the very one who established the covenant is coming, and he's bringing hell with him. And we're going to see about what the covenant means. So rather than them complaining about a God who's absent, obviously God doesn't care about us, far from it, God himself is coming and he's bringing the covenant with him. Do you boys, Clark, do you have a question? You do, you have a new King James Version Bible. I've seen it and it's very nice. Yes. Very quick. James, what do you got? What's that, buddy? Well, we'll talk about that offline, but a really good place to start is Genesis, where we talk about how God made man from dirt, from earth, that's what Adam means, and then he made Eve from the rib of Adam. And then we all are descendants of Adam and Eve. Pretty cool, huh? All right. So, the one who brought the covenant is the one who's going to enforce it, right? That's that messenger of the covenant. And of course, he's coming with as a Lord of hosts. He's coming with an army. And what we have to recognize here is that there's two parts of this fulfillment, right? There's the fulfillment of God coming in the incarnation of Jesus Christ. And then, of course, there's the fulfillment at the end of time when Jesus comes back, right? Not as a boy, but as the resurrected man at the head of the army that destroys evil forever. So both those things are contained within what we'll find in the next verse. Right? So what else? Let's go. Verse 2. But who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appeareth? So we should hear a little echo of this in Revelation, where it talks about, like, who can possibly withstand the end of the world? Who will abide? And then, of course, we see the entire host of the elect in heaven, right? That's there that John sees. But this is, again, a rhetorical question. Who can abide the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appeareth? The idea here is that the ungodly can't stand at this. They're going to fall, is how the rhetorical question works. But what's really interesting is how this is described, this day of his coming. And as I said, day of his coming, or the day of the Lord, does have this kind of twofold fulfillment, right? Like, there's all these things that happens when Jesus comes that point toward what will happen in the end times. He's resurrected, which is a precursor of the general resurrection. You have, like, those people walking around after, when he's resurrected. Like, what is that all about? It's because it's this sign, it's this portion of what's coming at the end that's already happening. There's all sorts of parts of that in the incarnation, but they're little things that are pointing towards the future. This is one of the things that Paul had the biggest problem with before he saw Jesus, right? One guy doesn't come back from the dead. It's got to be everybody. That's the general resurrection. And of course, Paul has to recognize he's actually not the one in control of the salvation plan. And then he's like, oh, okay, now that makes perfect sense. Then he sees it everywhere once he's laid aside his false dogmatic ideas. But what is this compared to? The similes here are really fascinating. For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. So like a launderer's soap. So the first image, the refiner, it's like it's a metallurgy idea. And of course, fire, there's levels to this, which is really cool. So fire, of course, is when you have the very fancy term for when you see God, it's called a theophany, right? So think of the burning bush, a theophany. What is involved in that? Fire. When you think of when Isaiah, he has the hot burning coal, there's like fire and all. Like, there's lots of times in which when people have Moses, of course, when he sees the glory, it's this kind of light and burningness, right? So there's all these kinds of examples of fire. You see it in the fire that led the people by night. You see it on Pentecost when the fire comes down. There's all these examples of the theophany happening. This seeing of God is involved with fire, right? So that's an aspect of this. So the God who's coming, it's like fire is coming, which is kind of a fascinating way to think about this. But what's interesting is fire, of course, is involved in judgment. I mean, we think of the fires of hell, for example. But it's not depicted here as an all-consuming fire. Like, you know, Paul will talk about our God as a consuming fire, right? So again, I always say we have to balance with, you know, God is love, and he's also that consuming fire. But the whole counsel of Scripture. But here, the fire is not a consuming fire. It's a fire that is purifying. It's a purifying fire, right? It's just like the soap is a cleansing soap is its purpose, right? It's making things clean. So what is incredibly important about what is being said here is that the fire that's coming, the God who's coming, is not a God who's just going to level everything and destroy it all. It's a God who's going to purify something. It's a God who's going to come and purify the priests and purify the people so that they can once again or give sacrifices that are worthy. Right? That's incredibly important when we think about what's going to move on in the future. I mean, given what the people have done, given what they've accused God of, what would be just and right would be for him to come in covenantally. What would be just and right would be to come in and destroy them all. But he doesn't. What he says is, I'm going to come in and purify it all to make it right again. And the only way that happens is by the invasion of God into the world. Again, there's this sort of a authority he has, right? He's the metallurgist making a thing, burning the dross off. Peter uses that exact metaphor to talk about us being in the fire, and that the dross is burning off of us so the gold can be seen. That's God doing that, which is really important. And of course, Peter uses it as a way of saying, when you're being murdered by bad people, know that the work of those evil people is redirected by God, who is using it to turn you into gold, right? Which is a heck of a thing to tell people. Because again, remember, Peter's general epistles to people who are being persecuted and being slaughtered for being Christians. So he doesn't use that lightly. He's going to be killed for being Christian in the not too distant future. And he knows that it's almost certainly his fate by this point, because most of his friends have all been killed by that point. Right? So that's not idle talk. But he also, because he is so confident in the reality of the resurrection and in the glory he's seen in Christ, he knows that there is nothing that can happen to them that would upend, or that, you know, that won't be used to create that glory in them as they saw in the eyes of Christ when he rose from the grave. Right? He knows that already. So that he can confidently tell you that and say that whatever they do to you, on the other end is glory, because he's seen it. Right? Whatever they do, they're in his glory. And that's also in this, too, that doesn't sound like fun to be in the refiner's fire or to be in the fuller's soap, right? Like a lie, like big, really harsh soap. That does not sound like fun, but who cares, right? It's the God who won't destroy you, even though you deserve it, is coming to purify you and make you clean. Thank God. Like, that's the only response you can give to that. Thank God that's what he's doing. And so what happens? Verse 3. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Right. So that's the idea. So sons of Levi, right? We talked about how the priests have failed in their covenant faithfulness, have failed in the offerings that they've given. The solution, again, is not them like having a retreat and really getting down in the deep into it and figuring out, you know, what they're, you know, figure out what's the issue is. What is going to save them and change them is the fire of God coming into them, right? Which, if you don't see the parallels between this and Pentecost, you're missing out. You're missing out, right? The thing that's going to cure the human person is not the internal looking in of something like Eastern mysticism, like finding my chi or something. That's not the thing that's going to cure you. What's going to cure you is the fire coming in and burning out the evil. That's what cures you, right? And that is a gigantically good news, right? But it's also very different from the lies we're going to be told by the world. Because there's just all sorts of industries and religions that are designed around the exact opposite idea. And a lot of them say they're Christian, and that's really hard. That's really hard. A lot of them say they're Christian. So the fire's coming, and it's burning out all the evil. And of course, now they'll be the offer, their offerings in righteousness. And that's the important thing. Again, it isn't just to offer a thing. It's to offer in righteousness, in the right relation to the covenant master, in the way the covenant Lord says to do a thing. Right? That is in righteousness. Again, it's not just a matter of offering. It's a matter of offering in righteousness. Okay, so verse 4, we'll finish off for the night. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto the Lord, as in the days of old, and as in former years. So, the priests are purified, and are now be able to give offerings in righteousness, and that, again, just as their evil trickle down to the people, so does their true offerings and their true teachings change the people in a way that redeems the entire covenant community, right? And of course, you know, the redemptive priesthood of Christ is all linked into this. So it's Christ gives himself on the cross, offers himself on the altar of the cross as the last great high, as the great high priest, the last high priest. He offers himself on the cross. And then our relation to sacrifice doesn't go away. We don't stop sacrificing. That's really key. We don't want to fall into the trap of saying all sacrificial language is Roman Catholic and we can't talk about sacrificial language. Because that's because Paul can, right? Paul talks about sacrifices. It's just not a propitiatory sacrifice of Christ over and over and over again. Instead, because of what Christ has done to us and what the Holy Spirit has done in uniting us to Christ, we can offer ourselves up as sacrifices, right? We can offer praise and thanksgiving as a sacrifice. We can offer our souls or bodies as a living sacrifice because of what Christ has done for us. He makes our offerings, and of course also the offerings of our priests for us, he makes those offerings holy and good and righteous through his priesthood. So no longer do you have to kill an animal, right? Because of what Christ has done as the great high priest, he has made us able to be offer ourselves and our praise and our whole person to God as something holy and unblemished, right? So it's like the holy unblemished lamb is you now because of what Christ has done to change you in a way you could never change yourself. Right? He's come. That's the incarnation. That is what the Spirit is doing with the fire inside of you and outside of you, right? And that is the glorious future of the church as it moves towards the return of the King, whose day will, of course, mean the end of evil forever. And so that's an idea of, it's kind of a beautiful idea of reformation and renewal that constantly should be happening. I generally hate the term Semper Reformata, mostly because it's made up. Like, nobody used it until the 20th century, but it's Latin sounding, or it's Latin, so it must be old, is one of the kind of funny things. Like, if you actually look up, like, when did anybody ever start saying this? It, again, it means always reforming. And it's one of the phrases people use. And they use it as a way of saying, like, every new era is a blank slate, and we can just kind of reinvent things all the time, so it ends up being used. That's kind of a dumb idea. But we should always be thinking, looking back to the past and ourselves, and evaluating whether we've moved out of the mission that God created for us and established us to be. That's what we mean by that. That maybe has some more purchase. And that's very much what I think we should be constantly thinking through and evaluating. Are we fulfilling the mission Christ has set us step for us. Are we living as people who are being purified day in and day out and being prepared for both this life, but more especially being prepared for the glory of the world to come? Like that, is that what we imagine ourselves to think? So that redefines our pain, right? That redefines our fatigue and our stress. It makes it not, oh man, I'm just being worn down and I'm gonna break here and I got nothing. It means, no, sir, you do not get to say that. But you can't, because too much has happened to you to be able to say that. You've been the recipient of too great a gift to fall down on your sword, right? No, even the pain, especially the pain, all of it is working towards making you a vessel fit for glory, right? And that is incredibly important for us to remember as we finish up Malachi, and as a course boy, we get into Romans, a big thing to bite off. But if we get to Romans, Nick, for our next book, oh boy, I mean, that's just all there. But any question about verses 1 through 4 of chapter 3 of Malachi? Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, of course it is. Yeah.
It's about one of the only few places in there where a guy really gets like thrashed, you know?
Yes.
And that was an eye-opener back in the day.
Oh, yeah. No, and that's an image we people are uncomfortable with to a certain extent when they think about what does Jesus do for you? Blowtorch. Yeah, but my goodness, do we need it? And we should recognize how greatly we need it, even when it hurts. Which how could it not? I don't know. There's no version of this image that doesn't hurt. There's no image of that. But that's soap, like being like.
And that lie soap.
Oh yeah,
I mean, that's,
yeah. That's some serious. It's not. What's that? No tears, baby shampoo. Like, it's like, yeah.
If you get lime on yourself, it'll literally
tear your skin. Yeah. So that's the imagery of it, and it's serious, and so we should take it seriously.